So our topic this evening is violence and peacemaking in the Vedic tradition. So I'll contribute some thoughts and you can also chime in. My first thought is that actually peace depends on violence. In a certain kind of thinking, peace just sort of, what is it? Think peace. You think peace and peace spreads and prevails. But realistically, peace depends on violence. And there's always a section of people who are inclined toward gross exploitation at the expense of others through violence or whatever it takes. Mm-hmm. And those persons are to be curbed by the government. Therefore, Rabindranath quotes that violence is that prerogative which is uniquely, the legitimate use of violence is the prerogative that's uniquely reserved for governments. Anyway, that aside, there's always a section who will terrorize, who will harm the peace-loving persons. Therefore, there's a section of people whose job it is to be violent toward them. That's Kshatriyas. Violence is required. If you want to have a peaceful society, there must be violence. Where there's a strong police force, there's peace. And where there's no authority, then peace will be very difficult to find. Therefore, Krishna himself comes, Vinashaya Jyotishkutam, to smash the demons. The demons means those who are lawless persons. The same thing when that Maharajanga left the kingdom. He just stole away in the middle of the night. Then the thieves all came out. So the rats will play, right? The mice will play. Maybe they were rats, the thieves and dacoits. In the absence of a king, they thought, all right, it's safe for us to come out. And they began pillaging and so on. Well, then the sages thought, there has to be some king. We'll, all right, this Vena, he's a nonsense, but we'll put him there. And he was effective. He got rid of the thieves, rogues. But he turned out to be a bigger rogue. Therefore, he was killed by the Prithumaraj. Sages said, let's try again, get someone. The right kind of person this time. So they got Prithu Maharaj, and Prithu Maharaj was powerful. Shauryam, Tejo, these are the descriptive terms for the Kshatriyas. You got to be powerful. You can't be a pansy and be a Kshatriya. Right? Prabhupada said, now the police come, and if there's a crime, the police come later and take notes. But actually the Kshatriya has to be so strong that people will be afraid to do anything illegal. So violence, then you get peace. Where there's powerful police, powerful government authority, then the people can live peacefully. Because the Kshatriya has to have that mentality. Soryam Tejo Dhritir Daksham, he has to be expert. And generous also. The Kshatriya has to be, it's not that he's just a person for smashing in every direction, smashing and crashing. But by exercising his power, he he arranges for the peaceful life of the citizens. He makes peaceful situation. Go Brahmana, for the cows, for the Brahmins, for the people in general. Cows, Brahmins, women, children, old men, they especially require protection. Any rat can come and steal from a woman, steal from an old man. So they have to be powerful. So the Kshatriyas are happy. What is that? Yadrichayacho papanyam swagadvaram apavatam sukhina kshatriya parti. The Kshatriyas become happy when there's a, because they have these qualities, quality for fighting. But they use it for dharma, for preserving principles of religion, principles of duty, good qualities, harmonious society. And they're happy. That came also, Parikshit Maharaj, he saw that there were signs of nefarious activities in his kingdom. So it was unpalatable that how these things have entered the kingdom. But on the other side, okay, it gives us a chance to get out there and fight. Well, certain Brahmins, they're not fighters by nature. They're peace-loving by nature. They're peaceful persons. But Kshatriyas, persons in the mode of passion, they by nature have a fighting propensity. Well, that should be used for the right purpose, and you get peace. This is one aspect, therefore we get the history of Mahabharata, Ramayana. This is peacemaking. It's all about war, but war and peace. Maybe I'll stop there and see if there's some comments on or other contributions. Yes?
To me, it seems that the issue here is this authority. And then, because theoretically speaking, what you were talking about, somebody should supposed to have, somebody who is a qualified person should have the authority and the power to punish this evil section of people. But the reality is that actually these people who are supposed to be qualified and righteous, when they become powerful, then they become corrupt, and then as a result they become evil.
Therefore it requires proper training.
Right.
Now the people are, you know, they have power and no training, or power and no culture. There's that whole chapter about the cursing of Maharaj Parikshit deals, at least one of its themes, is power without culture. Sringi had power, but he had no proper culture. So he got puffed up, and he was showing off to his friends. Yeah, much more like. But properly trained person. Therefore, the kings, they're actually there. If you look at the tradition, look at the tradition in the family of Maharaj Parikshit, their line was so noble. I can't allow such a thing in the dynasty of the Pandavas that an innocent cow could be beaten. So they had such their honor to uphold. You know, now your family name doesn't mean anything, especially in America. You know, that's just so what. But in proper culture, the esteem, the good name of your family is not to be diminished. So they were trained as a matter of duty to their ancestors, to God, to the people. And now they say, servant of the people. You know, the guy runs for office. Servant of the people. What kind of servant of the people? He's a pickpocket. Because he has no training. He has no honor. He has no sense of duty. Somehow or other, by hook or by crook, get into office, And then start lining your pockets, and the pockets of your the people who paid for you to get into office. You're just a paid agent of thieves, and you're a thief yourself. But a trained person, so noble they were. And they were like it's described, they were like the fathers of the citizen. You know, just as a father feels responsible. You know, now we have fathers, they exploit the kids, but actual father, he feels so responsible for his children. So the kings actually felt that way. These are my subjects, I'm responsible for them. Even in India and in the Middle East also, up till recently when there were kings, in India when there were kings, or still they have kings in some of these places, the king would go on tour and anybody could come. And the king would set up camp and the people could come, anyone, saying, this is the problem. And the king would feel, no, I have to do something. And he would make the arrangements. This some subject is unhappy, I have to do something. They would feel responsible.
But it seems in many parts of the world that sort of noble culture has been lost.
It's lost.
And then what's your suggestion, or do you think it's...
Bring it back.
Do you think is it possible?
Yeah. Everything's possible. By Krishna consciousness, by reintroduction of culture, it becomes possible. In training, becomes possible. Of course, our ultimate business is not to see that there's monarchy or there's this government, that ultimate thing is Krishna consciousness. So we'll take anything, democracy, monarchy, oligarchy, whatever, make it Krishna conscious and we'll take it. But actually this king, monarchy is good. I was on a train, Bombay to somewhere, and one of the people in my car happened to be from Saudi Arabia. So I was talking with him, and he said, actually, our system of government is better in our country, Saudi Arabia. He said, in your country, every 4 years you spend so much money, and you go through so much trouble, and so many things, such publicity, and you just elect another thief. He said, our country, we just keep the same thief.
Regarding monarchy's ruling of one man, I remember actually that we had in Krishna consciousness acharyas, presiding acharyas. But Prabhupada came and he introduced a collective governing body. It was something very new, and some of his good brothers were very...
Wasn't that new, it was just came from his spiritual master.
Yes, but some of his good brothers then also were very opposed to that idea. So that seems to me that in some way a monarchy is not so much recommended for Kali Yuga from this perspective.
Democracy is not recommended either. There's no recommendation in Shastras that in Kali Yuga, democracy eva gatiran yata. Prabhupada used to call it demon crazy. This is the reaction to corrupt monarchy. It's power to the people. And then what do? The people become what they hate. They all become little power grabbers. Or they manipulate. How to get votes, how to get in office. By cheating. By this technique or that technique, by buying votes, by rigging the rigging the scales one way or another, somehow get an office. And then a simple thing, manipulating the you know, what are the politicians, has become public relations. Starting especially, of course it was going on before, but very noticeably, everyone has noticed it, but starting with the Kennedy campaign, but the crucial thing was public relations. How you looked on television, how your sound bites, you know, your 20 second, or less than that, 10 second, little meaningless audio clips sounded. Nothing to do with how responsible you were, nothing to do with what your policies were. You know, if you looked young and sexy and got a figure of, you know, a responsible person. Nothing to do. I was in, again, it was a Middle Eastern country. They're a monarchy, but by Western influence, they were introducing some democratic institutions for the first time. So there you were driving on the street, and there were all these election posters. And actually, this monarchy is very suitable for the people there. It's been going on fine, but now we want to have, you know, democratic institutions. So they have these. They introduced like a parliament, and people could run for the parliament. So you had all these, you know, traditionally dressed Arab guys, and some of them were looking typically, you know, stern and you know, just as you'd think of they should look. And some of them were looking like very beatific, and they all had kind of Photoshop effulgences and and yeah, I couldn't read the Arabic, but the basic message was, choose me, I'll make you happy, you'll like me. You know, prostitutes, choose me, I'll make you happy. What is it? And no substance. And then what will they do? The Vedic system was actually, the king was the ruler, but he was not the top person in the state. The top person was the Brahmin. And the Brahmin had no power. He had no opulence of, you know, wealth and armies and all of that. But he had knowledge and austerity. And they would live in voluntary poverty. But they were the people who were guiding the government policy. So the government would get the best guidance at no cost. Yes? Not that you pay me $100,000 a year and I'll give you my good advice. Free. Brahmin can't become an employee of anyone. They were voluntarily giving their advice to the king, spiritually enlightened advice, practical advice also. They were sharp. And the king was so trained that he would respect and follow the advice of the Brahmins. Not that the king was a free agent to do whatever he wants. That wasn't the system. The king was subordinate to the Brahmins. So you had these people who were actually peaceful. I had no other concern. They weren't in business. They weren't in competitive. You know, they weren't trying to get a contract or a deal, they weren't going to profit by this policy or that policy. And get their relatives in and make a lot of money. And, you know, living like, you know, little huts. And they were cultivating knowledge. They were the ones who would advise the king, you should do this, you should do that. And the king would take it very seriously. The Brahmins are giving the advice. So the head was there for spiritual vision. How will this kingdom progress in such a way people will spiritually advance? And the king was so trained that he was practically just a notch down from a Brahmin. Rajarshi. Raja and Rishi. He was trained to respect the Brahmins, and he himself was also trained in spiritual understanding. But he had like a dual major, you know, he was spiritually cultured and he could fight.
And it's a really good philosophy. it works. You know, all the parts fit together. But then, you know, in the real world, you know, we talk about training, but then you go to, it's almost impossible to find someone to manage your local Hare Krishna temple. There's fighting and politics and, you know, where is that training? How does it play out? And
therefore, Prabhupada wanted Varnashram College.
You know, yeah.
In the present moment,
how do you get it started? How to do it? And you know, what's the practical steps you can take to actually getting towards something like, you know, a real leader?
They have to be seen who has qualification. If you see, I'll give you one example. There's one temple. They had a person in charge, nicest guy in the world, but no power. You know, wasn't a forceful manager. And the result was that all the thieves came out. And they were just, you know, drinking the blood of the temple. They're just drinking the blood of the temple. The person was, you know, like a round peg in a square hole. Very qualified person, very nice preacher, very brahminical person, but not a strong manager. So all the thieves detected that, you know, hey, it's open season here. So you have to select the right person for the right job. You know, the person in charge has got to be able to discipline those who are under his charge, and he has to know when to ease up also, not just that he creates a realm of terror. So you have to see who are the persons. It requires a little vision. Not an easy thing, and especially in this, you know, small labor pool and all that. But especially it's good if we see to the younger generation, those who've got what qualities, and pick, you know, grab them. Prabhupada, that was Prabhupada's expertise. He would see the qualification of someone. And he might be in some obscure position, we probably would. Even when we're talking about Hitler today, he's not one of our idols. But apparently he had some managerial talent, so that he would see some obscure person, you know, rank and file military officer, and if the guy showed signs of brilliance, he would be promoted right away. So, of course, that wasn't a unique managerial attribute of this particular gentleman. It just happened, if he's a gentleman, that we happen to be talking about. But that's vision, to see who can, you know, who are the people who can kick butt, as they say. And that's the kind of person you need to have in charge. And at the same time, that person has to know how to take advice, how to be submissive to spiritually advanced persons, wise persons, persons who can see the bigger picture. And some of the young people should be particularly seen, given opportunities and training. Otherwise, you know, we've got to start someplace. If you don't start grabbing it, lament, oh, we don't have anybody. It's planning. You have to start seeing, well, okay, we don't have any really qualified people. But then if you just take democracy, you know, everybody, you know, just have government by the people for everything, then you get ineffectuality. To get rid of heavy people in charge, then you have nobody in charge. So that we're no longer under despots. But then you get nothing happen.
You were saying this morning about our Alachua community. There's no one in charge, and therefore
everybody comes
there. And one might say, well, maybe that's some kind of success of that place.
Some kind of success, but it's limited success. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's a limited success. You can bring a lot of people, and you can, yeah, I mean, has a certain amount of, but it's you know, if you look at 700 people, and if you look at the, you know, the accomplishment of 700 people as a group, you know, what you could do is, and that's an army. And are those 700 people deployed in the most advantageous way for spreading the Krishna consciousness movement and for individually advancing in Krishna consciousness? That's another question. There's a certain amount of, there's an advantage. They're not being boxed into unrealistic managerial, unrealistic managerial authorities. But even a community, you know, would the devotees in Alatra like to see someone who is really so qualified that he could be a leader even of such, you know, senior and experienced people? Mm-hmm. Yes, you have something to say?
Well, it's half formulated, but just two thoughts in mind. One was when you said that violence and peace are linked together, that you that was very interesting. And then I was thinking, all right, so what is it that means peace? Is it the absence of violence? But then you have in the Gita, the peace formula, what it is to be peaceful is actually something even more profound. And then another thought came to mind was, I liked in the Gita, and again, Prabhupada, in some purport, I don't remember where, discusses ahimsa as actual non-violence, but actually we do violence unto others if we don't give them spiritual wisdom, or if we don't actually share what we know or share Krishna consciousness. So there's a sort of a patchwork of thoughts going through my mind. On the one hand, it's like you need a kshatriya to kind of kick butt, a wise kshatriya to kick butt to keep the peace, but on the other hand, then how much are we responsible for the fact that the kshatriyas don't exist and are not wise and are not kicking butt, and therefore we don't have peace because we're not actually preaching?
Yeah.
Or what do you say on this?
Yeah, that's if we don't train them, or we don't, you may find that, you know, apart from training, picking people in our own movement and training them, there's terribly qualified people out there. I'll give you an example. Qualified manager. We were stuck in, we were on Padayatra outside Varanasi district. And this Ram Janaki Rath was going around, which was very provocative. They were creating, it was a Hindutva parade, and it was creating communal violence, as they say, that is to say, Hindu-Muslim riots wherever they went. So Varanasi district passed an ordinance, no ruts. So that kept them out. It also kept us out. You know, we had our DD card, and there we came to the Chungi, the police checkpoint. And they said, sorry guys, you can't come in. So we said, hey, you know, we have a program, we've got, you know, everything's lined up, we've been walking, you know, 50,000 kilometers, we've got to go. Said, you have to see the DM, district magistrate. We can't do it, you know, we're just the police, we follow orders. So Lokanath Maharaj and I went out to the DM's bungalow, and it turned out that who was coming to town that day? I think it was Rajiv Gandhi, when he was prime minister. It was somebody, I think it was actually him. He was coming to Varanasi that day. He was flying in, doing some program, flying out. And naturally everybody else flies in, you know, all the big muckamucks, they all fly in there too. And the DM is the guy in charge of everything. So he's got all these millions of things going on that day. And when we got there, he was taking a little bit of rest. And then he somehow or other anyway, it was arranged that he would see us at such and such time, that he would squeeze in a few minutes. And then all of a sudden, around that time, the guy comes, you know, speeding out of his office. Such and such person, another guy had just flown in without letting anybody know. He's got to go out there and meet, you know, the minister for whatever it is. So he's speeding out of his office, he sees Lokanath Maharaj and I sitting there, you know, two sadhus. So he stops for a second, he says, come with me to my car. So he's, you know, like on his way out, he gets into his car, He rolls down the window. He says, "Swamiji, what is the problem?" So I start telling him the story about how we're stopped. He stops me in mid-sentence. He says, "Tell me in one sentence." I just stopped and...
The editor had to go.
Serious editorial mode. I composed one brief sentence and then spit it out. He just gave a few orders like that. He said, "Don't worry, Swamiji," and ran off in his car. Just like that. "Don't worry, Swamiji." Boom. Settled everything up and barked a couple of orders. And out he went. Those IAS people, they're terribly qualified sometimes. I had experience with a few of these people. Highly qualified people. They're just amazing managers out there in the material world. There's some people who are incredibly powerful, just incredibly good. You know, they can move that material energy around like nobody's business. So, by preaching, why shouldn't we capture some of them? We should make some and capture some. So, yeah, if we don't preach, we just like fetch. You know, we don't have managers, we don't have preachers, we don't have book distributors, we don't have this, we don't have that. That was me. You know, that'll get you real. That's Shudra. Shudra means one who laments too much. Vaiveya is me. Yes.
So we may ask the question about the conflict between material and spiritual qualifications. I remember that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had one manager who was in charge for Gaudiya Math, and he was very capable, but somehow his spiritual standards were quite low.
Yes.
But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati allowed that, and should be the case.
Well, that's for Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati to decide. But sometimes he said, you know, they would complain about him, and he would say, you know, because they knew he was taking money. He had said, "Well, to get such a manager, how much would I have to pay anyway?" And he had the vision, you know, this is who he is, let him do some service. And you guys won't be able to do it anyway. You know, he can manage, so it's worth it. So he embezzles 2,000 rupees or whatever it is, but he's getting the thing organized. So he had that vision. Of course, Prabhupada's vision is that we should be spiritually advanced and do the thing. But even Prabhupada, sometimes we saw that he favored sometimes a person to be in charge who spiritually drove everybody nuts. We could think of a couple of examples. People who just drove everyone up the wall. You know, they'd known not to chant, not to do this. But they were dedicated people, and they got the work done. So Prabhupada engaged them. He didn't say, "Okay, you get out," and put somebody incapable in charge. Now sometimes Prabhupada would also say, "You're not following the principles. You can't." You know, he was individual. It wasn't cookie cutter management where Prabhupada would always do the same thing the same way in every circumstance. Sometimes he would complain, even. Some other place, there was another manager. Devotees replaced him. They had a meeting. They had a democratic assembly. They all voted that this person should be replaced. And they put somebody else in charge. And this devotee had gotten big donations and gotten a fantastic temple and done a lot. And then the devotees there saw he was not chanting his rounds, this, that, so they replaced him. Then Prabhupada came. "But where is such and such?" "Well, Prabhupada, that he wasn't chanting his rounds." "How do you know he wasn't chanting his rounds? Are you chanting your rounds?" "Well, Prabhupada, this, that." "How do you know?" You know, Prabhupada wouldn't buy it. He said that he has gotten this place, and now he is disappointed. You know, you've demoted him to nothing. And now he's discouraged. So Prabhupada completely reversed the democratic decision, got rid of the temple president, and put the old man back in. So it requires a Brahmin. Popular vote is not necessarily Or is it Vox Populi? It's not Vox Dei. It's not necessarily God's choice, you know, that he speaks through the people. Even for those who like statistics, the most numerous people are also are always the stupidest. Right? People in greatest numbers are the people with the least mental qualification. And in a democracy, those are the people whose votes elect your leader. And the intelligent people are always the minority. Of course, things being, intelligence tends to come to the top, so the intelligent people figure out how to manipulate the big hordes of fools. Promise them this, promise them that, get their guy elected, and then pick their pockets. So the people are perpetually exploited, perpetually frustrated. And, but they're advertised that you can make a difference. It's your choice, da 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 da. But they're stupid. What choice will they make? Why did you vote for Mr. Such and Such? Well, he's really a man of the people.
Seems like you're saying we need an aristocracy.
Yeah, of course. The aristocracy means, of course, it has a bad name now. Aristocracy means a batch of puffed up baboons who are, feasting and drinking at the expense of everyone else and don't give a damn about anyone. But a real aristocrat, real aristocracy means a person with culture, a person with nobility. Noble doesn't mean, you pay some money and you get a title. A noble person was actually a person who had nobility, who had a sense of honor. Sense of honor. Like Lord, just like Dasarath, exiled his son to the forest, his son and heir, as a matter of duty, as a matter of honor. That was the kind of person they had. That's aristocracy. Not this, just batch of guys who are always partying. Like rich party animals. That's not an aristocrat.
At one time, Prabhupada started this In God We Trust party in America with different devotees running for different
public office
in the government. Do you know for what reason Prabhupada
stopped it? Yeah. Prabhupada had it in mind as a preaching platform that politics, everybody always wants to read about politics. Everyone wants to talk about politics. The whole, from now till whenever the election is, America's going to be all politics. Who's going to be the president? So Prabhupada had the idea, all right, they're interested in politics, so here's a platform. They'll run for, some of our men can run for office, and they'll speak about Krishna consciousness and our social platform. But Prabhupada's instruction was, just keep it very simple. Our platform is that the leaders should be men of character, which means four regulative principles, God consciousness, like that. Prabhupada said, very simple like that. And he said, if you like, you can say something about inflation. A little something. But then Prabhupada saw that on the practical level, it was becoming very involved, that you had to form a separate organization to accept contributions, because the nonprofit organization can't sponsor political candidates. Then you have to raise all this money to do this and do that. Then you have to, the whole atmosphere is actually a very filthy atmosphere, political atmosphere. And it wasn't just that you could field some candidates and they could preach. Although in the beginning, that's what they were doing. They'd be a candidate, have as much right to speak as the next guy, and they'd get up and say something. Although the rest of the guys were just like dishing out the usual platitudes our guys would say something with substance to it. But to sustain that sort of the campaign is to get into a lot of money, and a lot of the logistics of the thing just become overwhelming. So Prabhupada, rather than have everyone get complicated in this big, in the machinery of American politics, probably just say, can it. Don't sacrifice your spiritual life from all this. Where is money, and wheeling and dealing. Mm-hmm.
I'm not asked this, but in the Vaishnava tradition, because I have all Lord Chaitanya, says there's not this emphasis on the Varanas really. It could be Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and so on, so Krishna, and somehow it's this disregard for.
Well, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was a sadhu.
Yeah.
But then when he had one associate, the Patanayak family. So in these, Gopinath Patanayak was detected embezzling from the government. And he was sentenced to be, of course, it's a long story, but he was sentenced to be placed on the Chungi. The Chungi is...
Yeah.
Chungi? Chunga. It's kind of a more colorful version of a gallows. There's a platform of the trapdoor and sword sticking up underneath. And they open the door and you get sliced. So he was embezzling and caught and sentenced to death on this thing. And then the devotees came and said, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, your devotee has been sentenced to this, that. He's going to be killed. You got to do something. Gone against the government? Not my business.
Hmm.
He came back again and started saying again. He says, you come to me again, I'm leaving. And they all went quiet. Anyway, then the king found out and he realized that this person was a devotee and changed it all around, and the Gopinath Patanayak was promoted and the whole thing worked out fine. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu endorsed that you have to follow the government laws. And he didn't say, the government is bad, they're being so strong for such small offenses. It's the business of the government. The government is supposed to be strong. Prabhupada cited that in Jaipur, and under the previous Jaipur Raj, former Jaipur Raj, the law was that if anybody touched anything that didn't belong to him, he'd lose his hand. So there'd be stuff lying by the side of the road, some whatever it was, and nobody would touch it because everybody likes to keep their hands. So that was the strong government. Now, if they see something in your car, figure out how to get in and steal it. But back then, it could be lying on the side of the road and nobody would touch it. Hey, it doesn't belong to me. That was the strength of it. There's some incident in Saudi Arabia. I don't think it was the king, it was maybe a local ruler. But anyway, some traveler was going through the desert and from this city to that city, and he saw some bags lying by the side of the road, and gave it a feel with his foot and saw what it was. It was coffee beans. And he got to the capital and reported that there were all these bags lying there, coffee. And the ruler said, how did you know there was coffee? He said, I tested it with my foot. And the king had his toe amputated. What business did you have with this stuff? It wasn't yours. And the word spread real fast. That this is a...
What if it was a baby that somebody had left there?
Well, presumably the king had some discretion. But he made a real example out of it. People understood, if I mess with anybody else's property, it could be my toe. So that kind of, that's the duty of the government, to be very strong. And then you get law and order, just like the previous, anyway, I could cite different places. One place where country where law and order went out the window. The previous government was maybe too strict or whatever, and they threw it out and brought in a government that just let the thieves and rogues have a field day. And nobody is safe in that country anymore. Nobody's safe. People are... Anyways. So I'm a Krishna conscious rightist, you know. Right wing in America, the guys who are tough with one.
But I just thinking about the tradition and the ISKCON in a sense that we seem to a little bit mix managerial.
Well, of course, you can't just apply platitudes to ISKCON and say, okay, now we've got to have tough guys in charge, and then they make a bigger mess of everything. Everything has to be with discretion. Everything has to be, but we have to see from Srimad Bhagavatam what is the ideal system, and then according to the circumstances, see what we can do to come as close as possible. This kind of management, different things can be said, but it's a fact that at the moment there's a paucity of managers, and one reason is because that. No one wants a manager. People have had such bad experience with managers. Now nobody wants to be a manager. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants managers, and nobody therefore can manage. You're put in charge, and your pay is that you get to be the butt of all the criticism, and nobody listens to you anyway. Well, under those circumstances, who can do anything?
It's basically the same thing that led to democracy.
Yeah, in one sense. I mean, it's complicated. There are other things that come into play in the ISKCON history of the thing. How hierarchy broke down. Mm-hmm. In Prabhupada's time, ISKCON was extremely hierarchical. And I was just reading a memoir by Satsarup Maharaj about 1970 in Boston. And he was the president there. And at that time, there was this real family feeling. And the president was a very respected person, the temple president. The temple president asked you to do something, you felt like you really ought to do it because Prabhupada would want you to do it. And that you made advancement by following with like he was Prabhupada's representative. So the temple president asked you to do something, you'd think about, how fast can I do it? A new service. Or even if you didn't like it, you'd think, he's the temple president, you've got to do it. And a lot got done, therefore. Satsarup Maharaj wasn't the greatest managerial, he wasn't the one-minute manager, who was that guy at General Electric? I've forgotten his name anyway, super ultra managerial powerhouse. But he was sincere, he was dedicated, he knew what Prabhupada wanted, he organized things in such a way that things were in accordance with Prabhupada's desires, and there was tremendous cooperation in the devotees, and therefore there was a happy place. We were very naive, very simple, but there was the hierarchical values were in place there, and therefore it was you didn't have this everybody going nuts, everybody trying to figure out what to do, everybody organizing for or against this policy or that policy. There was a president, there was cooperation, and we had a good time. That was 1970. So, for various reasons, Sakalaneha Mata Yoga Nashtaparantapa. Now no one trusts, or leaders don't enjoy the same kind of trust. But practically we see that where there's good leadership, things go on well.
And I was talking to Tejas Prabhu. He was saying that a temple is basically everybody in the temple has their own vision of what the temple ought to be, and they're all trying to sort of execute their vision independently of each other, and therefore you've got maybe 20 or 30 people there but there's no cohesion. Whereas if you have a situation where everybody, even if you have three people who all agree, this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to do it, then you can accomplish, far more. And that, I mean, that seems to be like a fundamental problem. Yeah. And partly just because, you know, you get people that move in, they move in with one reason. One person moves in, I want to study. Another person moves in, I just want to lead a very contemplative life. Another, I want to preach. Another, everybody comes there for a different
purpose. Well, it's the genius of the manager is to be able to see, well, here's the guy who can preach, and here's the guy who can, you know, guard the door at night, and here's the guy who can do cook and cook, and here's ideally the leader should be able to see, here's the guy who can do this, and engage everyone, therefore Prabhupada said, according to their propensities. And that, even that, I may sacrifice my propensities for the greater cause sometimes. And, well, you know, I'd like to do this, but they need someone to do that. But the manager keeps in sight, here's this person who's, you know, he's got intellectual capability, or he's got, he could make the finances move, he can collect, he can do this and that. So the spiritual master, or the person in charge, he ideally has that kind of vision. And even if he doesn't, if he's humble, then he takes advice from those who do. And he may not be the best manager, but if he takes advice, that's, you know, we can trace some of our ISKCON difficulties to that. You know, people who are like omniscient. You know, they're so spiritually empowered. They're divine representatives of God, and therefore, even though they couldn't manage their way out of a paper bag, you know, they've got their hands on micromanaging everything and everyone. That, you know, that doesn't work. Therefore, the beginning of knowledge is humility. And the Kshatriyas were humble. Real Kshatriya, even though he was, you know, like passionate, so, but, you know, he knew what his limitations were, that I have to take guidance from people who have wisdom. So if you have that kind of, you know, that's the quality of a good leader, ready to hear a good idea from somebody. Even in a corporation, or, you know, the guy who kind of wanders around and picks up a good idea from the guy in the shipping room or something. He doesn't say, well, I'm the boss, I know, well, you know about shipping. He hears. So, and again, to try to figure out all of this kind of history and micro, you know, it's, hey, anyone want to do a thesis? Poli-sci? This is a, you know, you can get a degree and do a bestseller at the same time. Yeah, make a bundle of the movie rights. Yeah, sitcom. A lot of spin-offs on this one. And we'll send some people out to sell paraphernalia.
Back to violence and peacemaking.
Presumably not all this stuff is going to go into this.
And if we can mix in a little bit of rasa theory into the mix, we say Shantaras is kind of on the lower end of the scale of rasas. We put Madhurya on the top. We also say, I'm just thinking aloud now, we say the material world is an inversion of, or a reflection of the spiritual world. You were saying that peace is somehow dependent on violence. And I guess the question is peace the best one can hope for in the material world? And if it depends on violence, well, yeah, we can say it's inherently unstable if it depends on violence in some sense.
Well, firstly, the material world is inherently unstable. It's not a peaceful place. by nature. So peace is always provisional. Of course, in Satya Yuga, it's more conducive. Kali Yuga is tough. But there's something else that you said, and I was missing it. Oh, then one time Srila Prabhupada was talking to Radha Balaba, and he was saying something like, the materialists all want peace. He said, we're not interested in this peace. He said, we want service. It's not that, you know, we want war, but Prabhupada, you know, the materialist, his idea of peace is kind of kick back and, you know, I'm a lazy boy, have a few beers and go to sleep. Or, you know, love and peace, you just kind of, everything's peaceful and you just kind of relishly, you know, another beautiful day in San Diego. But Prabhupada's idea was service. That we're not, you know, we may be peaceful or we may be disturbed, but we want to serve. It's not that we want simply peace. We want, you know, Shanta, therefore Shanta is not so highly esteemed. Just to be peaceful, it's like inert in one sense, like a jellyfish just kind of float down the ground or something. But we want, you know, Prabhupada said, devotees always daring and active. We go out there and do something to please Krishna. Maybe, you know, maybe to collect, it may be to manage, it may be to study, it may be something, but activity of some sort, not simply peace. Prabhupada himself, he was the example, you know. He had peace in Vrindavan, but could have just stayed in Radha Damodar and, you know, rung the bells and seen the deities every day and been peaceful. But he came out here to deal with all the wild animals. More?
It's very interesting to hear you say that when Prabhupada was here, it's very hierarchical. And I'm sure that's true. I never thought of that before, because I was living in a temple where there was about 10, 12 brahmacharis. And it was extremely egalitarian and really no hierarchy, and also very dynamic. There's a lot of book distribution and everything. And when Prabhupada disciples used to come, they used to say, this is just like when Prabhupada was here. So I guess that's probably not to do with the leadership so much. But it was very interesting. So I kind of had this idea that when Prabhupada was here, it was much more egalitarian. But my question is really, it seemed when Janaki started off with asking the original question, that leadership really does somehow, does it pertain to the material world so much? Because in Vaikuntha, is people really need to be led?
Yeah, but spiritual world, there's leaders also. There's different groups of gopis, and they have their leaders, and cowherd boys must have their leaders.
Is it the same thing, though?
No.
How would you differentiate between it?
It's like gold and iron. Okay. It's not the same thing. But there's some resemblance. It looks, you know, if we looked at it, we say, oh, they've got hierarchy. I mean, look, spiritual world, they've got the, you know, supreme personality of Godhead.
But that's the thing.
God forbid.
People don't know that Krishna's God, right? That's,
well, of course, in Goloka Vrindavan, the Goloka Vrindavan, Nanda Maharaj is in charge. And, you know, Krishna is very hierarchical. Krishna is respectful to his elder brother. I mean, Indian society is extremely hierarchical. You know, if you have an older brother, the older brother has, right, priority. You can't just...
Not my younger brother.
Yeah. But very, you know, yeah, like in America, you know, we call our parents by first name and chew them out when we're upset with them. But I was talking to someone, big industrialist in India, who's our devotee, and he was telling me the history, how he was helping in his father's. His father was a big industrialist, also his father's business, and then he worked in this other things. And then when I was 28, my father gave me permission to start my own business. Permission. Right? In America, you know, do you ask your dad permission to go out and start a business? Right? You just do it.
With his money.
Huh?
With his money.
Yeah, with his money. But he, you know, there's so much respect for the authority. The authority of the parents is very strong. You know, you can't join the Krishna consciousness movement if your parents are against it. It's like very, very hard. People, I mean, even we're talking about responsible king, responsible. Like still in India, the sons feel so responsible to their parents. You know, why don't you join? No, my parents are there. I have to take care of them. You know, America, it's like, yeah. I mean, responsibility is now. You know, like, who's taking care of your mom? My dad. How old is he? 82. There's not any feeling that I have to do anything. You know, maybe pay a few bucks and keep him in the old age home, but, you know, if I don't do it, the government will pay. But, so this is broken down. Hierarchy means the guy on top is the guy with the most responsibility. It's not that he's the guy who's the biggest enjoyer. That's what they're running for office for. The guy who's on top gets the most perks. But in real society, the person who's the higher up you go, the more you have responsibility. The more you're bound by duty. Anyway, ISKCON in Prabhupada's time, you know, he established every temple had its... Of course, he didn't want it to be too, you know, overbearingly, managerially top-heavy. Prabhupada was very careful about that also. Not that it just becomes a big bureaucracy. But each temple had a president. The president, Prabhupada, told us, was his representative. Above the presidents, after a short while, he created his GBC men. GBC was a powerful position. You know, they gave you... You know, they were supposed to give spiritual instruction, managerial direction, oversee things. GBC was powerful, Prabhupada's time. It wasn't just, you know, somebody that you gripe to, and GBC was powerful. Or griped about, now that I'm gripe to. But Prabhupada, and powerful meant responsible. And responsible meant they blew it now and then, so Prabhupada, or quite often, so Prabhupada would, you know, Prabhupada was on the top of the hierarchy and he was beating them. You know, what are you, who told you you could do this? Why didn't you ask me? You are a fool. Prabhupada, GBC man meant you got the maximum. Yeah, maximum punishment. And Prabhupada, you know, the rank and file guys that didn't get so much mercy, the GBC really got it. Something was wrong. You know, who is, call in such and such. Right? Call in, you know, if something was wrong someplace, you know, or some devotee was pointing out something, right? Who is the GBC? And so many things Prabhupada didn't answer, you know. So for this I'm referring, you know, such and such is your GBC man, so I'm referring that you may kindly approach him. Especially in the later years, it wasn't like Prabhupada wanted to deal with everybody's marital problems and you know, this one disagrees with that one, and you know, the temple treasurer has a complaint about this and that. So such and such is your GBC man, you may kindly consult him on these matters. So responsibility. And training, Prabhupada said, you know, I'm training them to do this and that. Training was there, responsibility was there, and respect was there. Especially, I mean, and some of these people were great leaders. Even if later some of them had, you know, serious difficulties or left or whatever, but when they were leading, things happened. Books got distributed, temples got built, devotees got trained up. When you have leaders, things happen. So, of course, we've learned a lot about in one sense protecting our leaders also. And especially you start mixing everything, spirit management with spirituality and everything. Prabhupada one time, Tamal Krishna Maharaj was traveling with the Radha Damodar party, and he was of the opinion that the temple presidents should all be brahmacharis and sannyasis. He said, because how can brahmacharis work under householders? Well, you know, there's, how can they respect the householders and work under the direction of householders? How can the householders be leaders of, you know, men, brahmacharis? So he was saying to Prabhupada that actually, you know, he's advocating that the temple presidents should all be sannyasis and brahmacharis. And Prabhupada acknowledged that, and he sort of seemed to agree with that. And he said, from the other point of view, he said, sannyasi means cool brain for preaching. He said, none of the temple presidents should be sannyasis. So there's that side of it also. Ideally, your sannyasis and brahmacharis should be free of management. These things are all have to be seen according to the individual circumstance. But it's a fact that there are people who naturally have a capability for leading. And it's also a fact that most people prefer to follow. They want some direction. They don't want to, what do I do today? You know, what am I supposed to do? And they just look around, if there's no one to say, you know, we're going this way, they look around and say, you know, which way should I go? And that's the majority, really. People want, you know, they want a leader. They prefer to have a leader, and then they know where we're going. And you put, you know, animals, there's a leader. Some they elect, or, you know, some animal by his prowess or something becomes the leader, and there's an order. The other animals follow. It's natural. And in human society, too, I can think of a couple of persons, one person, I say, you put this man in a room with 10 people, he'll be the leader, and there'll be 9 followers. This is his nature. He'll be the leader, because he's a leader. Constitutionally. And the other people are not leaders. When you put them in a leadership position, it's like, what do I do? So seeing who the leaders are. Seeing who the leaders are and putting them in a position where they can lead. Responsibility, accomplishment, and so on. Leadership is work. It works.
Yeah. Maybe this is voicing like the concern not only of ISKCON, but just like people in general post enlightenment. There's a famous saying, I think it was somebody around the time of Kant, and they said, I'd rather screw up my own life and make it my own screw up, my own mess, than have someone tell me what to do.
Yeah.
And even if I'd rather search for myself and understand things for my own self than to have someone tell me what to do, even if they're right.
Well, that's our present mentality. That's our postmodern democratic spirit. That everybody, you know, I'd rather be wrong by myself than right under some guidance.
It's
just a changing. I'm just reading a sociology of religion book, and to a marked degree, this is a change that's occurred since, say, World War II. That previously, like, there was allegiance to a denomination, you belonged to a church, and you followed the teachings of your church, and you had, you know, you felt a duty to support your church and so on. And there was a kind of sense that the community and the nation and so on were something you were bound to. You had traditional ties to, you had duties toward, you received benefits or guidance from. And that picture has changed, so that now things are very much in the individual mode. you know, I have to find it for myself. I have to choose for myself. I'll put a religion together out of, you know, a little Buddhism and a little Hinduism and a little Baptism and a little Wicca and a little of this or that. And the religion is very much, you know, what does it do for me? You know, what is its therapeutic value? What is its, you know, it's all about me. Very individual centered. I'm not passing judgment on that, I'm just the other thing has, you know, it has its advantages. It means there's this real sense of personal integrity, spiritual search, of
autonomy.
You know, there's something that can be said for it, but it's what is. It's changed, and it has its advantages, but it has real loss associated with it also. Even you get in family affairs now. There used to be a kind of a hierarchy. There used to be a, you know, duties and expectations and so on. It's out the window, you know. It's like, you know, everyone's, like, it's all about me. And marriage is very much about, you know, about what's going to make me feel better, what's going to make me help me realize my full potential, what's going to help me satisfy my you know, my desires for success in life, what's going to make me a whole person. It's all about me.
Human potential movement.
And, you know, I'm just reading in ICJ, you know, this peer counseling and so on, which I have nothing critical to say about. I don't know that much about peer counseling and so on, but there's a very, this therapeutic mode is very prevalent in ISKCON now.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, what does it do for me? What is this marriage doing for me? Well, I realized that I wasn't, you know, couldn't express my Krishna consciousness, you know, da 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 da. So I, you know, I found somebody else's wife, and she helps me so much in my spiritual, you know, progress, and we're very happy. And how can you be Krishna conscious if you're not happy after all? And she was stuck in a relationship that was not going anywhere, and da 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 da. It's all about me and my personal fulfillment.
Guru too. What's my guru doing for me?
Yeah, what's my guru doing for me? What's my, you know, what's anybody doing for me? And so, you know, in the sense that I have responsibilities, that I have duties, that there's hierarchy, you know, that somebody leads and somebody follows, that children have duty to parents, that's not very strong either. And we'll be in crisis mode over that pretty soon. You know, because the ISKCON will be supposed to be responsible for everybody, right? It's not the parents will be responsible for children, children will be responsible for elderly parents. You know, ISKCON will be responsible for everybody, and if they don't bring everything off well, then it's another, you know, it's the leaders again who don't know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But there's, you know, very much that, a kind of selfishness, which comes from comes from false ego and from a lot of other things. But when you get this when you get this very predominant sense of one's own individual, everything revolving around one's own individual self, it has its advantages, but it has its serious drawbacks. I think a lot of devotees who are into democracy, you know, whether they say so or not, who, you know, feel strong democratic tendencies, feel, you know, strong need for personal fulfillment and wholeness and all this kind of stuff, are probably not aware of how much their feelings and perceptions are influenced by, I guess, you know, our modern culture. How these are values that are associated with, you know, 20th and 21st century Western value, Western life. And, you know, it's just, these are just like givens, and they're not examined. You know, why is it that my own self-fulfillment is in this instance more important than my duties to the community or my duties to family integrity or, you know, my duty to my kids. You know, people are breaking up, and there's no sense of, I guess there is a sense, but previously that sense was stronger. I think when I was a kid, I knew exactly two people who were divorced. And it was, you know, like, it was kind of a serious thing that they were divorced. And now it's, you know, now it's not even a question of divorce, it's a question of, you know, married, divorced, second husband, third husband, fourth husband, seventh wife.
Serial polygamy.
Sorry?
Serial polygamy.
Serial monogamy. Serial polygamy too. And now the question is not like which girl I should marry next, but should I marry a girl or a boy?
Am I a girl or a boy?
Huh?
Am I a boy?
Right.
That's the burning question some people
say. Yeah. And again, it's about, you know, what makes me feel, you know, feel this, that. And it's a tremendous feeling that the state has to respect the privacy of others and the individuality, and, you know, and okay, we, you know, we're not going to argue about that. But these are like the value, you know, more than other values that might have prevailed before. Now it's, you know, the extreme importance of the individual, his privacy, his individual rights, da 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 da, and not nearly as much sense of. You know, forget the idea that there's a cosmic order, you know, a great chain of being and all of that, starting from God and extending downward. That's like tyranny. That's tyranny. We want individuality, and then the individuals go berserk.
On a lighter note.
Hmm?
On a lighter note.
On a lighter note.
You mentioned Boston Temple in the good old days.
Mm.
There must have been some crazy things.
Oh, there were crazy things. There were crazy people, too. We used to have crazy people living there. The guy who ran out in the snow in the middle of the winter in his underwear. And he wasn't taking his medicine.
The same thing happened last time I was there.
Really? Still going on?
He ran out in the snow, but...
It couldn't have been the same person.
Same time.
Well, it's good to see that some of the traditions are being maintained.
At least he had his underwear.
Yeah, he did have
it. My guru Maharaj, Hridayananda Goswami, told me one story about the Boston Temple, that he went there, I think, in 69 with Satsarup Maharaj, and he was the Bhakta leader.
Yeah.
And he had a very nice group of bhaktas, and at one stage after this one bhakta had joined, and he'd been there about 2 or 3 weeks, and then after 2 or 3 weeks he came up and he said, Hridayananda Goswami, can I talk to you for a while? I said, sure. He said, is this the Maharishi movement? I said, no, it's the Hare Krishna movement. Oh, right, thanks. And I said, no.
Real winners.
Stay for another week.
Anyway, we have a nice, colorful history. You're going to write a great thesis.
Can I ask? How do you, like, really thoroughly differentiate between the sort of gross egocentricity you're talking about, or it's all about me, and that original sort of quest for self-knowledge and for self-realization and those things which you also do?
It was there in the Varnashram system. People would fulfill their lives in relationship to God. If a person was a Brahmin, intellectual, he would undergo severe austerity, he would live, you know, he'd abnegation, give up so much, accept discipline under a guru, and, you know, really study the books and preach, you know, really actual. I'm not going to lead the state. I don't know how to make money. I can never start a business. Yeah, I can serve. So everybody had a place in the order of society. So society had a shape, a proper shape. It had engagements for everyone according to their what they could best do. It didn't promote a person who was, you know, fit to star in grade B movies to the post of, you know, governor of, you know, 20 million people. Who knows? Guna karma vibhavsha, according to people's qualities, according to the work that they actually could do. And people got fulfillment. It's not that, you know, I have to go out and do something, you know, try this movement, try that movement, try this therapy, try this process to be fulfilled. You did your duties and you were fulfilled. You know, if you were a mother, then you do your job as a mother and you think, I'm doing this for Krishna. Or you're a wife, mother, and you're doing this for Krishna. If you're a man, you think, I'm doing this for, you know, I have to take care of my wife, I have to take care of my children. So in family, so that's, you know, what do you want for fulfillment? I'm not happy. You know? I didn't realize what a drag it would be to be married to you. You know, you're incompatible. You know, it's all about me. And then, you know, everything can be sacrificed for my self-interest. Not my self-interest, my personal fulfillment. My sense of wholeness. My right to be who I really am. You know, for that, everything else can go hang. And then what right is that? It's the right to be frustrated. The right to go out and do it again and with the same result. You know, your 17th wife, your 142nd husband, whatever it is, and it's the same thing. It's your karma. You were going to be unhappy in married life, so now you're unhappy in the next marriage, that's all. But in the Vedic system, that even if you don't like it, you do your duty and you get rewarded. You know, the reward, duty has its own rewards. By performing your duty in Krishna consciousness, that's how you feel whole and, you know, now I'm going to be whole, but without Krishna. You know, I'm just going to arrange things in such a way that I'm going to be whole. Because I'm going to live naturally and I'm going to, you know, do yoga and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to meditate and I'm going to go to, you know, I'm going to join a support group and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that and I'm going to be really fulfilled. And, you know, but you don't need Krishna for that. You just need to be who you really are. Because who you really are is an idiot. You're frustrated. But the Vedic system is that everyone acts in accordance with his duty. For the sake of satisfying Krishna. When Krishna is satisfied, you'll be satisfied. It's a different set of ideas. But it works better.
I think that's one of the things that sort of we lose in our culture is this understanding that actually duty can be very fulfilling. I mean, somehow, like, people think it's just like a given that if you're doing something because you have to, it can't be fulfilling because it's not what you want to do, you know? So you do what you have to because you have to, but then you find something you want
to do.
Right? And somehow the two can never be the same thing because I don't know why, but by definition they're two separate things. But, I mean, in reality, I think if you do perform duty, that really gives you a sense of purpose and it gives you a sense of fulfillment that, you know exactly what you must do. And therefore, like you gave the example of Maharaj Dashrath, you know, he did that as his duty, but to know that is absolutely...
Die.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, to know that that's absolutely what you're supposed to do.
We even had that conception still, you know, if a person dies for his country. You know, I would rather die for my country. You know, a person, he's tortured, but he never tells, you know, never betrays his, you know, his countrymen or whatever it is. We still think that's good. Well, why? You know, the guy, if he just cut a deal, he could have, you know, walked out of there, gone back to his family, and, you know. But still we have some conception that duty is higher. But we, you know, we don't extend that conception very far. It's good in somebody else, especially if you, if I'm the beneficiary. You know, these people who die for my country, they're really great people.
Thanks.
I disagree with trying to get totally.
Oh, good.
Almost this gets exciting now, because it's I think it's the word disconnection is very central here, because I think this whole culture of finding yourself and being fulfilled and this whole postmodern approach is actually all about disconnection. You actually, like you said, that the chain of being is all just removed. And you think you can find that connection in all of these things. How can you please me? Or how can this serve my senses and my needs? But actually it's through service or through duty that you're actually connected to Krishna. So even if you don't like your husband and you serve your husband, it's not that the relationship is just you and the husband, it's actually you, husband, and Krishna. And there's that immense sense of connection, and that's our nature. You know, if it either is or it isn't, and if it is true that we are exist in relationship to Krishna, then it's about connection and service and duty. Do that.
I don't know if that means you disagree with Radhika Rama, but
I completely agree with him.
Oh, agree with it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Agree. Yes.
Maybe I said disagree, but I meant agree.
You agree, yeah.
The word that comes to mind when you speak is about responsibility, isn't it?
Responsibility.
And I think you can be a responsible follower, and then you try to be an irresponsible individualist, you know, in a sense.
Mm.
But you're responsible in the higher scheme, or, you know, in relation to other people, and in relation to your, yeah, to Krishna somehow. And I think when you, yeah, responsibility and service, then you can be individualistic in that sense, but you're responsible. But it's not how do you say, you're not, it's not that you're not, you're doing it because you want to serve.
America's and the modern world has romanticized this idea of the individual, you know, somebody who goes off, you know, goes against everybody else and does something totally, even to the point where Madison Avenue has figured out that, for example, convicts are chic. Yeah, you can sell stuff, you know, like if you want to sell like an MP3 recorder or something, if there's some thug who's in Sing Sing or, you know, San Quentin or something, and he's into it, you know, that's cool.
Rap music is, it's all about,
yeah, it's all about
being a thug, right?
Sticking it to everybody else. Yeah, you know, that's become like, but that's basically the extension. You just, you know, what's your identity? It's formed by what you're against. You know, who are you? I'm against everything. I'm against this. I'm against that. I'm against this. But that's, as you say, very disconnected.
Like alienation, anomie, all that stuff is exactly that disease.
Yeah.
Also, it's interesting, in the second canto, Brahma performs a yajna to create the universe.
Mm.
And Prabhupada says that it was out of bhakti that he did that. He created the world out of love.
Mm.
And Prabhupada defines love as sacrificing your own personal interest for the pleasure of another.
Mm. Austerity.
And that, so the self-centeredness, but also it doesn't allow the possibility of love. Because you can't love anyone but yourself, with the speaking of God.
Mm. more, or we wrap it up?
I just would like to make a comment. I mean, I think I just told you that I come from Mauritius. It's highly unfortunate that there has been throughout generations and system like traditions and parampara transmitted, and we have now been made like the donkey and the carrot, follow this dream of capitalist enrichment, of progress, of GDP, of production, of everything you see which is beautiful around the country, then you've got business potential. And a lot, I think probably my parents' generation was the last generation where there was still this, you know, strong feeling among everyone, where there was kind of, you know, belief in the tradition coming from the roots. And in my generation, it's very, very unfortunate that things are turning the way. And I think it is important that we use political force to actually... That's why, I mean, I'm thinking that in my place, in my country, it's so small, it's quite manageable. And you've been talking about political force being used for thugs and everything, but I think the way, because political force turn good things into bad things, and I think it's only political force which can turn these things back. And I'm just wanted to make this comment, and that's like
purified political force.
That's exactly, and it's very unfortunate that people don't realize where they have everything like that. It's been given, it's just there for them to pick up, like my friends, my everyone around me, it's just there, and even me, I didn't realize it. I just took it for granted, and everyone rebels against it, they just think, what is this, you know, they have eyes look away, you know, look towards the West. And I think it's only politically that it can be approached, and because politics, you can filter it down to education, you can filter it down to institution, you can filter it down to giving birth, and that's a comment I would like to make. And I think you really have to look at situations and adopt it. I mean, being a small remote island, it's easier in that way.
Mauritius is such a place that it could be very strongly Krishna conscious.
It is. It has a huge potential.
And proper leadership, proper.
And we. I'm not going to boast anything, but you do get to admire Krishna's beauty. It's very forming. People are strong there for satisfying a bunch of shareholders in London who wants to spend 1 week having fun. Destroying fantastic lagoons. All in the name of progress and GDP.
Exactly.
That's the comment I would like to make, and that's why I'm not against people getting training, but training for a higher purpose. And but the training is being made, they've been trained in an economic school in a Western way of you should go back to your country and put up this bank and set up this business. I'm not going to follow this training, I'm following the other training. And I hope Krishna will help me with that training. That's a comment I wanted to make, because I think I'm quite unique in that background, coming from a small island into a huge threat.
Good, thank you. That sounded like the bell. Or is that just follow? Good follow. Very good. Yeah, I think we can. Hare Krishna.